not early. It's 9:38. We'll probably use all of our time today. So let's go ahead and get started. Plenty of spaces. Please, if you haven't sat down, please join a table where someone exists already, because there might be an opportunity or two to engage with folks at your table. All right. Thanks for coming to week two, Study in the Barn, on America's Christian Heritage or America's Christian Origins. I think I've given this thing three different names, and so you're bound to find some different descriptions or titles of this as the weeks progress. So last week we began with sort of the founder's vision for America, and I was just wondering if you guys would be willing to share with me, if you were here last week, what is one thing you took away from our time together last week if you're here? What's one thing you remember from last Sunday? Yeah, yep, yeah, 34% of the quotations in the founders' journals were direct references to Scripture as they were meditating what to put into the Constitution. 34%. All right, good. What's another thing you took away from last week? Yeah? Yeah, three branches of government is directly taken from Isaiah. I think it was 33:22. That was where our balance of power came from. Yep. Sheila, did you have your hand up too? Yeah, 29 of the 56 signers had degrees from what we would consider seminaries today. That's great. Yep. Anything else you took away from last week? Yeah. Yeah, wasn't that fascinating? A constitution in America is the longest-lasting constitution in the world. It's lasted 231 years, whereas many other countries have scrapped the whole lot and started all over again afresh. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Last comment? All right, cool. A couple questions emerged. I've spoken to a handful of you since last week, and some of you are saying, where did you get the information for the stuff we're going to be talking about over this four-week period? And so I actually put together just a quick slide. Three summers ago now, I read about six or seven books over the summer, and I decided that it was just so fascinating to get to go down this road that I wanted to try to kind of compile what I was reading into a teachable format. So we referenced Democracy in America a couple times last week. We'll reference it more this week. I think we're going to see Alexis de Tocqueville every week that we're together. That's a phenomenal and very insightful book. America's God and Country almost functions like an encyclopedia. It's just a book of quotations, and it's just listed alphabetically. So this is a very interesting reading as well. And then the ones in the bottom are the ones I've probably spent the most time with. David Barton, if you haven't heard his name, he is a significant voice in this whole effort for Americans to understand their origins. He has a ministry that was formed many years ago, which I would say, strangely, is named Wall Builders, which is a fascinating idea right now in America. But his ministry is called The Wall Builders, and he has written and researched and studied and published prolifically on this idea. And the nice thing about David Barton's content is that you can actually get a lot of his stuff in DVD form if you prefer to consume your information visually. You can get a lot of David Barton's research put together in like a video form of consumption, which is great. I love Eric Metaxas. He's got a very witty and very interesting style of writing. He used to be a speechwriter many years ago for one of the presidents. And so you can find, he also wrote the Bonhoeffer biography, the Wilberforce biography. He wrote If You Can Keep It. Newt Gingrich has written a lot on this. Oz Guinness has written on this. So these are some of the books, in fact, the primary sources I put together for our time that we're going to be together over the 4 weeks. Okay? Now, before we kick into today, I want to start us off with a question. Okay? St. Augustine said this a lot of years ago. He says, what defines a people is the thing that they love supremely. What defines a people is the thing that they love supremely. I want us to be thinking about, as Americans, what do you think is the thing that we as Americans, as a people, what do we love more than anything else as a people group? Okay? Think about what is our nation's highest ideal, all right? Introduce yourself to the folks at your table. We're going to take just a few minutes on this. Introduce yourself, say hi, and then if you could weigh in on what you think Americans value above anything else or love above anything else, go ahead. I don't want to hurry up our time when we've got a chance to interact with folks at our table, but I'd love to hear some thoughts. What are your suggestions? What are your ideas of what America loves supremely? What came up at your table?
Freedom.
Freedom. Same there. No, anyone else?
Equality.
That's great. Anyone else? Hope. That's good. Well done, guys. Well, so here's what I would suggest. Here's what I would land on. I would also agree that I think more than anything else, Americans value and love freedom. That would be the thing that I would look at this as well. We don't need to look very far beyond our Constitution, our amendments. We don't need to look very far beyond our experience. We love freedom of thought. We love freedom of speech. We learned from that interaction with the Kentucky student at the Abraham Lincoln Memorial last week that we love freedom of assembly, freedom to demonstrate. We love free elections. We love the freedom of the press. We love freedom of religion. We love freedom of expression. We love free elections. We, the capitalists in you, love free markets. And strangely, we love freedom to decide what gender we are in America. We love the freedom to decide what bathroom we want to use based on the decision of what gender we think we are in America. There's no doubt that this freedom can go a little bit in strange directions. But nonetheless, I would say that as an American people, we value freedom arguably above all things else. In fact, I think you could make a pretty persuasive argument for the fact that our greatest export to the rest of the world has been freedom. In fact, I've read a couple historians say that our two greatest exports to the world have been blood and freedom. We believe in freedom's ideals so much that we will help other people to get it when they're against all odds. There's something in the American psyche. I think it goes back to our own origin story, where we don't like the little guy getting pushed around by the big guy, because that's who we were. But when we see little guys getting pushed around by big guys, something happens to us, and we say we're going to stand up and we're going to help fight for that person. We've rescued Europe twice, right? We've gone to places like Egypt. We've gone to places like Iraq, right? And we've gone, we've stepped in places, and we've left our blood on the battlefield of these places to help little guys be redeemed from their oppressors, from their tyrants, from their tyrannies. Freedom is arguably our greatest export to the world. Now, in some of these pursuits of trying to help other people to discover or find their freedom, we've discovered a hard truth, right? Specifically, I think of when we've gone to Egypt to help with this, when we've gone to Iraq to help with this, we've discovered something very difficult. And here's a Tocqueville quote for us to kick us off today. He says, "Nothing is more wonderful than the art of being free, but nothing is harder to learn how to use than freedom." Freedom, my friends, isn't simply a matter of removing shackles, whether they be literal or whether they be figurative, right? Freedom isn't just eliminating someone's oppression and lifting them out of it. So much more needs to happen in order for freedom to actually work properly. Case in point, liberation of Iraq. We went in there. We removed a hostile dictator. We helped them to get rid of a tyrant and oppressor. And we said, okay, you are now free. We bid you be free. Now govern thyself. How'd it go? Not very well, right? What we discovered is that there's a unique type of maturity that's required in order for freedom to turn into prosperity, okay? Said another way, there's actually a danger within freedom that can undermine freedom, that can make it difficult to deal with, all right? Let me make an example. How many of you know someone who is grossly overweight? Can you raise your hand? Okay. Does anybody know anyone who's addicted to internet pornography, right? Some of you might know or are friends or acquainted with someone who is addicted to alcohol or nicotine or some other substance. What went wrong in these situations? Now, I know I might be painting too broadly with this, but as a generalization, these people abused their what? Their freedom. They abused their freedom, okay? Now, I know that there's an exception, so don't get on me. Don't send me emails, okay? I know that some people who struggle with weight have a thyroid problem. I know that some people who are alcoholics are third and fourth generation alcoholics, and maybe there's something we can point to medically that would explain that, but by and large, we can say that the people who have gone too far with the love of food, too far with the lack of restraint looking at the internet or with substances and so forth, these people have not observed restraints on their freedom. They've taken their freedom too far. And I can say this with a high degree of confidence because a good friend of mine is a recovering addict who's currently living in my home. I've watched him walk this hard, hard road for a number of years. And he would tell you that his over-exercise of freedom has actually resulted in something that much more resembles enslavement. And if you know the obese, if you know the addicted, they would say the exact same thing. The over-exercise of freedom does not feel like freedom anymore. And that's going to lead us to a paradox, which is going to point us in the direction of our time together today. And that is this: unrestrained freedom undermines freedom. I'll say it again. Unrestrained freedom undermines freedom. Freedom in and of itself does not point to, does not necessarily land on prosperity, success, and thriving, right? It's not a natural outcome of freedom. You think of yourself when you're younger, right? What do you want to be when you grow up? What are the dreams you have? What would you like to become? Oh, I want to be a dancer. Oh, I want to be a doctor. Oh, I want to be an athlete. This is Nashville. Oh, I want to be a musician. Great. Do you want to be a great one? Yeah, I want to be the best there is. Well, what does this individual need to be thinking about as they have all the hope and all the opportunity for the future? They better take their freedom and they use it to express discipline, self-control, diligence, right? They need to actually govern or self-impose restraints on their freedom in order for those dreams to be realized. If they just engage in self-indulgence, their freedom will not take them to where they want to go. You agree? A metaphor for this is a kite, right? You let a kite out into the air and it soars and it floats and it dances in the sky. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It's free. Or is it? If you cut the string of the kite, the thing that's actually imposing restraint to the kite, what happens to the kite? Falls to the ground. The restrainer of the kite is that which lets it soar. That's a metaphor for where we're going to go today. Freedom needs to observe restraints in order for it to work. Now, track with me on this. Freedom needs to observe restraints in order for it to work, but we live in a free country. The only type of restraint that we can impose or that we can offer that doesn't contradict the very idea of freedom itself is self-restraint. I'm going to back up and say that one more time. Freedom needs to observe restraint in order for it to work. But the only kind of restraint that doesn't contradict freedom is self-restraint. And our founders knew this, and they understood this idea. And this is the direction we're going to be going today. They actually wrote about this idea prolifically. Now, at the bottom of page one in your handout, I intentionally left, I don't know, 3-ish inches at the bottom. That's intended to become a sketch, okay? We're going to, as we go through the slides, as we go through our content today, we're going to be kind of revealing a sketch. At the bottom of page one is where you can start to draw that, and you'll see this coming forward, and it'll make sense by the time we're done, okay? The first idea I want to connect with you on is this, is that there's a relationship between freedom and virtue. In fact, you could say that freedom requires virtue. Okay. This is an idea that was put forth by our founders. Now, let me give you an example. In the year 1787, Benjamin Franklin was writing a letter to two of his friends in France. The Revolutionary War had been over now for about 4 years, and America was now at the time where they're starting to put together what their government is going to look like, what their constitution is going to look like. And in this letter, Benjamin Franklin has it's just two or three paragraph letter, but he has this quote in his letter. And he says, only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. What does he mean by this? He's not saying that freedom and virtue are somehow connected or they're somehow interrelated. No, he's saying that without one, the other is not even possible. Okay? He would actually go on in this letter to say that as nations become more corrupt and vicious. Now, don't think of vicious as like a dog attack. Think of vicious. Vicious comes from the root word vice, right? So as nations have more vice, as nations become more corrupt, he says in his letter that they have greater need of masters, okay? So he's saying that there is a direct correlation between freedom and virtue, and that the lower the virtue, it begets less freedom, right? Less virtue would necessarily beget less freedom, okay? John Adams would echo this exact same sentiment in a letter in, what was the year of this one? 1776. So this is the year of the Declaration. He's writing a letter to his cousin Zabdiel, and he says this. He says, "The only foundation of a free constitution is pure virtue." And interestingly enough, he goes on to say, if this cannot be inspired into our people in a greater measure than they have it now, they may exchange rulers and forms of government, but they will not obtain lasting liberty. Isn't that interesting? Again, I'm going to highlight just a few of the key words here to point your eyes at it. The only foundation of our free constitution is what? It's pure virtue. And if we can't inspire this into our people, these guys will trade tyrants, they will trade tyrannies, they will swap one form of government for another, but they will never be free. Adams says this is the key that's going to tie it all together to have a nation of free people that are governed by themselves. Now, there's a quote in your handout from George Washington, I think. It says, the foundation of our national policy will be laid in pure and immutable principles of national what? National morality. Washington says, if we want freedom, if we want our policy to be successful, it has to be laid in morality. Now, this was fascinating to me. As I was going through this, I was looking for quotations even outside our founding fathers. And there was an ancient Roman philosopher slash statesman, a guy named Cicero. Remember this? You will probably all recognize this name. Like, well, who the heck was Cicero? I didn't know anything about the dude. He lived around 100 BC is when he was born, and he functioned in the Roman Republic until about 43 BC. But he said this. What a fascinating quote. "Citizens whose character and virtue can be weighed are worth more to the Republic than the citizens who can only be counted." Isn't that interesting? Citizens whose character and virtue can be weighed, can be somehow tangibly measured. We can see that there's a goodness in people. They are worth more to the Republic than the citizens who can merely be counted. What do you think he means by that? What's he getting at with this? What else? Any other thoughts? Yeah.
It's important to not only speak truth, but do truth.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. And when we do truth and not just speak it, is our whole environment better? If it starts in your house, if you have Bible studies with your children in your house and as husband and wife in your house, do you become a little bit more like the author of this book, right? If you wash yourself in this every day, if you strive to, as Rob was talking about today, as we become sanctified, as we become more like Christ, our conduct changes. When our conduct changes, we interact better in healthier ways with the people around us, right? I'm convinced that a Fellowship Bible is able to fulfill the vision that we've been working on for the last, I don't know, 6 months or a year. The renewed vision for who we are as a people, Christ-centered, Spirit-dependent, better together. If we get that, if we really embrace that and we follow through with that, do you think our whole community is impacted for the better? Absolutely. And I think that's what even Cicero is saying, right? The goodness that we have, it contributes to our surroundings. It contributes to our environment. Now, Alexis de Tocqueville, we looked at Democracy in America last week. This guy who was, if you weren't here last week, Tocqueville is a guy who was asked by the French government to make a journey to the United States in the late 1820s. He was sent by his government to investigate what was going on in the American prison systems because the American prisons were empty and the prisons in France were packed full. And so the French government said they must be doing something better to rehab their prisoners, to rehab the people who are in their penal system. And so Tocqueville was sent to America to understand what's going on in America that's causing their prisons to be empty. And when he was here, his observations of the way of life in America would go far beyond the prison systems. He found stuff in America that he thought was just fascinating. And we looked at a quote last week in your handout, which basically said, "I was looking for the genius of America. I was trying to figure out what was the greatness of America." He said, "I looked in their harbors, I looked in their fields, I looked in her matchless constitution, I looked in her mines." But he said, "It wasn't until I went into her pulpits and found that they were aflame with fire. that I discovered the secret and genius of America. It was in her churches that I found the secret of American success. Well, remember, Tocqueville coming out of France, this is a country who went through the French Revolution 10 years after us. And their revolution, although it was shortly lived after us, it resulted in all kinds of beheadings, political upheavals that would follow in the decades after the revolution. It was a nightmare, and it did not end well. Well, what was different between France and America? In France, they got rid of their monarch in the way that, in a sense, we did, but they also kicked out the church with it because the state church and the government, they were both sharing power. They were both considered to be oppressive. They were both considered to be abusive and corrupt, and they kind of threw out the church when they threw out the monarch, okay? Tocqueville, looking at America, one of the things that he would say in this regard as well, which is in a concluding statement in Democracy in America, I love this quotation. You will have seen this or heard this before because it's been cited by numerous American presidents. Eisenhower, Reagan, and Clinton have all built this into their addresses. Here's Tocqueville's quote. He said, America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Again, he's looking at the link between our freedom and our virtue, and he's making the same argument that John Adams and Benjamin Franklin were making 30 and 40 years prior. So the secret, according to our founders, was that virtue is a requirement of freedom. You cannot have freedom if you do not have virtue. Okay? Now, we're going to continue to build the shape out a little bit. The question is going to become, where does virtue come from? And according to our founders, virtue comes from faith, all right? Faith is required. Religion is required, according to our founders, if they're going to have virtue. And the idea among our founders of divorcing religion from morality to them was unthinkable, okay? Now, we're going to look at a couple of quotes this morning from some of our founding fathers, and just due to, I'm not sure if it's the word choice of them or their style of writing, some of these are a little bit harder to read, so we'll kind of work through them together. The first one I want to look at is from John Adams, right? Adams says this. He says, we have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. I'm going to hit the pause button there for a second and kind of do some quasi-translation. He says, we have no government armed with power, right? We do not have even a strong government that is what? That's capable of contending with human passions. Our government can't contend with our human passions if they are unbridled by morality and religion. He says, avarice, which is extreme greed, ambition, revenge, these would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a whale goes through a net. Isn't that crazy? He goes on to say, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Adams is saying, our government, as strong as it is, it cannot contend with the dark sides of the human nature if it is not bridled by morality and by religion. Our Constitution, we're outmatched. Just like a whale will go through a net, our Constitution can't bear up to the pressure of an immoral or an irreligious people. Our Constitution was only made for a religious people. It is inadequate to govern any other. Wow. That's interesting. So Adams is saying that the secret to self-government is that the people themselves need to be self-governing. Right? The people themselves must be self-governing. That is to say that the citizenry in America, they must be motivated towards good behavior by something besides just the laws of the land. Okay? What's interesting to me as I look at this quotation is that Adams seems to have no idea that future generations, I'm talking about us, he has no idea that future generations would not only loudly argue against this, but would totally miss this point. Right? He would have no concept that people in our day today would think that conversations about religion and morality would be completely besides the point in conversations about self-government, right, and freedom. Our country doesn't associate religion with self-government today at all, but our founders thought they were absolutely entwined together. Now, we have strayed a long ways from the founders on this idea, all right? And I'm going to kind of make a point for that today, and then we're going to have a chance to talk about it a little bit. But let me give you one more quote from Mr. Alexis de Tocqueville, all right? This is also in his infamous book. Tocqueville says despotism. Now, this is a word I don't use very often, so I looked it up. Despotism is oppressive use of absolute power, okay? He said despotism may govern without faith, but liberty cannot. Religion, he says, is much more necessary in the republic which they set forth in glowing colors, referring to us, than the monarchy which they attack. Now, are we attacking monarchies with our army? No, we're arguing against the monarchy. But he says that despotism, you might govern without faith, but liberty can't. Religion is more necessary in the republic that you're trying to create than in the monarchy that you've thrown off. He goes on to say, I love this one. How is it possible that a society should escape destruction if the moral tie is not strengthened in proportion as the political tie is relaxed? What can be done with the people who are their own masters if they are not submissive to the deity? I love this quote. Yeah, did you have a question? I'm sorry. It is Tocqueville. If I put John Adams in there, I'm sorry. It is Tocqueville who said this. Yep. I discovered on Friday that I had not yet sent my handout to Jeff Runyon, and I quickly edited my teaching notes, and I probably didn't cut and paste the name properly. This is de Tocqueville. How is it possible that a society should escape destruction if the moral tie is not strengthened as the political tie is relaxed? Isn't that a great visual? If we're gonna take pressure off of our people from a political environment, they need to somehow strengthen their own restraints through religion, right? Through their own moral ties, through their own moral system. For me, that is an extremely helpful visual, because people do need to observe some form of restraint, right? So that we don't have crazy making out there in our society, right? Tocqueville understood that the law cannot force people to do what is right, right? And he argued that when there is no human sovereign, right, when we don't have a monarch, that there must be another sovereign. And in America, that sovereign would be God himself, to whom the people would freely submit themselves, okay? Now, freedom. What's a requirement of freedom? We need virtue. What's a requirement of virtue? Our founders are going to say that in order for us to have virtue, we have to have faith. We have to have what they would call religion. Now, when you read the founders' writings, they talk about religion a lot, okay? In the way that when we think about religion, I know that Christianity would be considered a religion, but we think of it as a relationship with Christ, right? We know that we can have a direct relationship with Christ directly. You don't find that same kind of wording in the founders' writings. They consider Christianity religion. And again, for us, there's kind of connotations with that word. Religion seems for me to imply a little bit of distance, not as much relationship, but some of this might just be the context of what their writings look like and their understanding or the word choice they use. It can be difficult to understand their meanings of some of their word choice, I guess is what I'm saying. Okay? Now, why did the founders feel that faith or that religion was required to have virtue, all right? The founders were concerned with questions like, what is virtue? What does it mean to be virtuous, right? What happens to someone if they're not virtuous, right? They were trying to look at this and determine, how can we get our citizens to be virtuous? Well, we need to make sure we're driving them to an understanding of what, in fact, is virtue. If we want a virtuous people, where do they go to get this learning? Where do they go to get this understanding? How do we teach virtue? And they found that as they went to the faiths, and I say that with a plural, when they went to the faiths, they found that the religious writings, that the faith-based teachings had a lot more to say about the content of virtue, about the inspiration of virtue, than any of the other writings that were out there. They looked at the secular philosophers of their day, and they determined, they were convinced that these secular philosophers could not make a sufficient case. They could not build a sufficient foundation needed to instill virtue in the wider citizenry. Okay? So we're going to look at, you know, in our world today, all right, the founders would say, hey, if you're going to be virtuous, you need religion. In the America we're living in today, as you know, we're in the public square, in the court system, in the schools, they've challenged this idea. They're saying, hey, we don't need religion to be virtuous, right? We've actually replaced faith and religion in the schools. We've punted it, right? We've gotten rid of it. And so the question is going to be, if we actually get rid of religion as the cornerstone for how we build morality and virtue, then what's going to teach virtue to our people. The founder said that when we go to the secular philosophers, there's not enough content there. There's not enough substance there to inspire virtuous living, to inspire morality. So that's why they said religion, organized religion, right? Faith is how we're going to teach this to our people. They did not see a way to teach this any other way. Okay. Now, in America, that doesn't land very well right now. We're gonna look at this in the next week and the week after that. The decisions we made as a country to actually evict the Bible from our schools. What was the result of that? Why did we come to that conclusion? What changed, right? As we look at this, we need to be cautious that if our faith, if our religion doesn't teach virtue, then what does? And what's interesting is that in a farewell address from George Washington, when I say farewell address, this is the speech that he made when he stepped down from public life. This is the hero of the Revolutionary War. This is the guy to whom we look at and say, thank you, he won it for us, right? He was our first president. He was elected back to a second term. This guy walked on water in the American eyes, right? He was incredible. There was some concern that Washington wouldn't actually step down from power. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. There was a lot of people who didn't want him to step down from power because he was so effective. He was so good. But nonetheless, in the formation documents of our country, there's a two-term requirement, two-term limit. And so he released power. He passed it to his successor. But on his way out the door, in his farewell speech, this is in 1796, Washington is going to give his last address as a public person. And he says this. He says, let us, with caution, indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education, right? So whatever good we have in refined education, there seems to be something that's creating a good reputation or a good amount of momentum around refined education. Whatever we can concede to refined education, both reason and experience forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles. He's saying, be careful. We know that we're valuing education. We know that it's good, right? But we must be cautious because we cannot teach morality without religion. That was George Washington's perspective. And it was these kinds of words, it was these kinds of addresses to the American people that became kind of the foundation for the precedent that would follow in our Supreme Court for many, many years. We looked at some of these last week. I'll just give you a quick example of this, for example. Vidal versus Girard's executors. We talked last week about Stephen Girard, a wealthy Frenchman who emigrated to Philadelphia, who when he died, he left a fortune that he wanted to be used to build an orphanage and a school. And he said, the $7 million I have as my fortune is yours. You may build a school, you may build an orphanage, but you may not teach religion there. And Philadelphia, of course, said thank you, but no thank you. We don't want it if that's your stipulation. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and of course, the Supreme Court decision was this. The purest principles of morality are to be taught. Where are they found? Whoever searches for them must go to the source from which a Christian man derives his faith, the Bible. There is an obligation to teach what the Bible alone can teach, a pure system of morality, right? So the Supreme Court said we have to teach the moral best to our people. That is an obligation we have as Americans to teach the moral best, and it was considered that the moral high ground was found in the Bible. Now, this very notion is contentious today, right? Some people don't like this. This doesn't land very well when these words are shared in the public square. I remember being at Biola University. This is where, when I lived in Southern California before coming to Nashville, I completed a master's degree at a seminary there in apologetics. I had a chance to listen to a handful of debates between Christians and atheists while I was at Biola, and they were all fascinating. One of them was a debate between a guy named Christopher Hitchens. Have you ever heard of Christopher Hitchens? And probably the foremost defender of Christianity using apologetics as an instrument, a guy named William Lane Craig. And to see these two people debate was fascinating. But one of the things that came up in the debate between these two men was a statement by Christopher Hitchens, who's now the late Christopher Hitchens. He died back in 2011. But Christopher Hitchens looked at William Lane Craig, and Hitchens says, name one moral act that you can do that I can't. And it had nothing to do with the content of what was being discussed in the debate, but Christopher Hitchens decided to color kind of outside the lines and say, what's one thing you can do morally that I can't do, was kind of his statement. And it was an interesting kind of a left turn in the debate. And the reason for that is probably all of us in this room, if we were honest, we would say we might know one or two people who are non-believers who we might look at and say, you know what, they actually live better lives than some of the Christians that I know. And again, not forgive me if this sounds condemning, but I know a couple of people who profess Christ for whom I think Jesus is their Savior, but not quite yet their Lord. And they haven't really bowed a knee to the Lordship of Christ. And as a result of that, sometimes they don't live really great lives that we would point to be an example of someone who's a Christ follower. I think Christopher Hitchens was aware of this, right? But the question becomes, is religion still an instrument that points us in this direction? Even though we might find an exception here or there, is faith, is religion still the tool to try to drive the morality of the people? And the answer to that is yes. You know, even some of our founding fathers, even like Benjamin Franklin, said, hey, if men are wicked as they are, we see them right now with religion, can you imagine what they'd be without it? This was his take on it, right? So I'm in agreement with this. The teachings that we're going to have from this book, it changes us. And I was trying to envision, what would America look like at the time of the founding fathers, where our kids report to the schoolroom, and they've got to open up Matthew 5. And for the first 2 hours of the day before they get to mathematics, they're going to study the Sermon on the Mount, right? Extremely incredible, very practical, ethical teachings of how to live your life. What would happen to your kids if for 2 hours every day they've got to be guided by a teacher on the applicable learning of the Sermon on the Mount before they set to their day? What would happen to you if you had to digest 2 hours of the Sermon on the Mount, discuss it? What does it mean? How do you apply it? If that's how you start every day, what happens to you? Can we see how this would change our country in a positive way? Most of us, we look at this book, and some of us probably in the room, we open this on Sunday. We go to James. We've got this little thing that marks our spot. It's right where we left it last time. And the last time I saw my Bible was last Sunday at 8 o'clock. We know that the more time we spend here, the better we become as people, because it changes us, right? And this was something that was not lost on our founders. We know we become better people when we soak in the Word and when it informs us, when we strive to apply the moral teachings of Jesus. Now, our founding fathers got this, by and large, right? Not all of them were mainstream Christians. Not all of them were. And I could put up on the screen quote after quote after quote of the people who marched right in line with, you know, Orthodox Christianity, but I don't think that would be very interesting, okay? I want to show you some quotations of people this morning who were outside the mainstream. I want to show you what the founding fathers thought of Christianity and of the Bible who didn't exactly, let's just say that they wouldn't be the normal representatives of Christianity. These are people who are outside of the average founder's beliefs, okay? Ben Franklin is actually one of these people, which might sound weird to say that considering the speech you read from him last week on the floor of the Constitutional Convention. I love that speech. But here's what Franklin said about Jesus Christ. He said, as to Jesus of Nazareth, he's writing to, if it matters to you, he's writing to his guy named Ezra Stiles. This is from a letter in 1790. He said, as to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals and his religion as he left them to us to be the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. Is he saying I am a devout Christ follower? Nope. But he's saying that what this Jesus guy taught is the highest that I have ever seen in terms of moral teaching and is probably the best we're ever going to see. Now, a free thinker among the founding fathers was a guy named Thomas Jefferson. He is widely considered the least religious of the founding fathers, but even he has something to say on this subject, which I think is fascinating. I don't have this on a slide because it's just a series of quotes. This is in your handout. By the way, you need to know that Jefferson would have considered himself a Unitarian, and when I say that, that means that he kind of looked at the best that was to offer from all the different religious faiths and kind of found truth in all of them, and he desired to kind of synthesize that. That's the Unitarian's view. Well, Jefferson left his house one morning, and he was heading down the road with a thick red book under his arm, and a friend of his, a guy named Ethan Allen, stopped him. And I don't know if Ethan Allen is the guy that would one day start a furniture chain. I didn't look that up. But the guy's name was Ethan Allen, okay? And he stops Thomas Jefferson. He says, "Which way are you walking, Mr. Jefferson?" And Jefferson says, "To church, sir." "You going to church, Mr. J? You don't believe a word in it." "Sir," said Mr. Jefferson, "no nation has ever existed or been governed without religion, nor can be. The Christian religion is the best religion that has ever been given to man, and I, as chief magistrate of this nation, am bound to give it the sanction of my example. Good morning, sir." And they parted ways. Now, again, Jefferson's not saying, I've yielded my life to Christ, he is my Savior and my Lord. He is saying that I'm going to give the example of going to church because it is the best, right? The Christian religion is the best religion that has ever been given to man. What's interesting about Jefferson as a non-believer, he wrote a treatise, he wrote a little summary in 1820 called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Thomas Jefferson wrote this, right? So, crazy. In a sense, you could argue that Jefferson is just paying Christianity lip service. He's looking at the utility of the Christian faith. The people of the country need this. I'm going to give it my example. If we're on the subject of people who are paying Christianity lip service that are just looking at the utility of it, let me pull up one of my favorite ones I found on this. This is a French philosopher named Voltaire. You ever heard of Voltaire? This is no lover of Christianity, just so you're very clear on that. This guy hated Christianity. In fact, he was certain that within 100 years of his death that Christianity would be wiped from the planet, okay? This guy was very outspoken against it, and he felt that religion was not for people such as himself, right? He felt that respectable people such as himself did not need Christianity or religion. But here's what Voltaire says about religion. He says, "I want my lawyer, I want my tailor, I want my servants, and I even want my wife to believe in God, because it means I shall be cheated and robbed and cuckolded less often." You're like, what does cuckolded mean? It implies adultery. I looked that one up, all right? But he wants everyone who can affect his life to believe in God, because he will be cheated less often. He will be robbed less often, right? There will be no adultery in his world, right? He wants it for other people. Voltaire is making my point for me, guys. People live better when they're under the teaching of the Bible, when they live in a system that points towards the religious faiths to teach morality. I think it's fascinating that people who are antagonistic to Christianity even can see the utility of it in a country. Okay, now, you might know this, you might not, but I'm going to give you a fun Trivial Pursuit tidbit that you can feel free to pull out of your pocket anytime you have a religious discussion with someone. Do you know that when Voltaire died, that the Geneva Bible Society bought his house, and they began printing Bibles on his press? Isn't that awesome? You think God doesn't have a sense of humor? Yeah, Christianity will be gone in 100 years. Here you go, sucker. We're going to make good use of you, right? All right, so that's Voltaire, okay? So freedom requires virtue. Virtue requires faith and religion, okay? Now, let's go a little further with this. Faith requires, the last section of this that we're going to look at is that faith requires freedom. We're going to kind of complete the whole triangle. And if you go back to your front page, this is kind of the golden triangle of freedom. This is the little doodle or the little sketch I left space for you to have on the front of your handout. Okay? So the last part of it is that faith requires freedom. Now the question becomes for us. Were the people in early America, were they free to choose their own preferred version of faith, right? The founders knew from their own experience in Europe that there has to be a right relationship between faith and freedom. When faith isn't free, when faith or belief is mandated, when there's a state church that tells you what you will believe and what you will do to express that belief, they knew that it's a disastrous relationship for both. In Europe, it was common to see a very oppressive relationship between a corrupt monarchy and an oppressive state church. They tend to work hand in hand. And again, what happened in France was when they overthrew the monarchy, they overthrew the church as well. They threw the baby out with the bathwater. We didn't do that in America. We fled here partly to obtain religious freedom. We knew that the abuse of religion doesn't negate the proper use of religion, right? Yes, we were oppressed. Yes, it was used as a political tool in Europe, but it wasn't going to be that way in America. We know what this thing can do when it's not corrupted. And the founder said, we're going to do this differently when we form America. Okay? Religion cannot be a force in the hands of the government. And I've got a cool quote for you on that in just a little bit. But for religion to work, it has to be free. It cannot be forced. Now, you might say, wait a minute, Mike, I can already tell you what you're talking out of both sides of your mouth because you've shown me a number of quotes in your fancy presentation today and last week that the founders really kind of nudge people towards Christianity. That was clearly the religion that they wanted people to have. Yes, it was. Why? Because that was, in their eyes, the moral high ground. That was the best that we could teach our people as regards to morals and conduct. But were they required to observe Christianity? Were they required to embrace it? No. Let me give you a quotation from one of the other founders, one of the signers of the Declaration. This is a guy named Benjamin Rush, Dr. Benjamin Rush at that, actually. He says, such is my veneration for every religion that reveals the attributes of the deity or a future state of rewards and punishments that I would rather see the opinions of Confucius or Muhammad inculcated upon our youth than see them grow up devoid of a system of religious principles. I would rather our children embrace Confucius. I would rather they embrace Muhammad than grow up in a system where there is no religious principles. He goes on to say, but the religion that I mean to recommend, just like the Supreme Court in 1844, in this place is that of the New Testament. All its doctrines, all its precepts are calculated to promote the happiness of society and the safety and the well-being of civil government. Are the people allowed to choose? Yes. Are they encouraged to choose Christianity? Yes. Why? Because it was considered by literally all to be the moral high ground. It was the best that was available, and that's why the Bible was required reading in our schools. Where are they going with this? The freedom of government from religious control and the freedom of religion from governmental control, that freedom, right, between religion and between the state, that had to be maintained, right? And that's where our First Amendment comes from. And we're going to dive into this next week. We're going to look actually at the First Amendment very closely because that's our point of departure from where we've always operated as a country to where we are now. It's all around the First Amendment, and we're going to look at that next week, okay? The First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Said another way, there can be no state-defined orthodoxy. There is no state church. We do not require a specific religious belief. When you don't require it, when you don't define it, then there can be no heresy against the state church. That was extremely important to the founders. Okay? Now, you might be asking, what about the freedom not to believe? Were atheists tolerated in early America? Were people allowed to not have any religious belief at all? What happened to the Stephen Gerrards of this world, right? This immigrant from France that lived in Philadelphia. I take you back to the founders' writings. John Adams says that government has no right to hurt a hair on the head of an atheist for his opinions. Government does not have the right to step in and hurt a hair on the head of an atheist for his opinions. However, he would elaborate, it would be better to turn back to the gods of the Greeks than to endure a government of atheists. Now, I want to wrestle with this one. What is he saying? It would be better for us to go back to Zeus, Apollo, Hades, Poseidon, Athena. It would be better for us to go back here than to endure a government of atheists. Someone take a stab at this. Why would he say this is preferred?
Because at least there's a belief system.
There's a belief system? What was over here?
Belief in something is better than belief in nothing.
Belief in something is better than belief in nothing. Okay? What else? If you live in this era, right, and you behave poorly, right, you have bad conduct and the gods are watching, what happens to you? You get punished? If you live well in a way that pleases the gods, what happens to you? Are you rewarded? Yep. So I go back to Benjamin Rush's quote. Come on now. All right, there. Such is my veneration for every religion that reveals the attributes of the deity or a future state of rewards and punishments. I'd rather see the opinions of Confucius or Muhammad than see them grow up in a system devoid of religious principles. If people are feeling like their conduct done well will result in some kind of a reward, or conduct done poorly result in some kind of a punishment beyond this world, there's something to motivate the behavior. There's something to drive the behavior of the people. And that's why I think they're saying, I would rather go back to this than as opposed to have a government full of atheists.
It's arbitrary, capricious though they were.
Mm-hmm. With all the baggage that this came from. Yeah, the gods were very selfish, and the gods were random. And you never really knew if you were pleasing them or not. Sometimes they just show up, and they'd be in a mood, right? But they're saying even this is better than a government of atheists. Now, that may not sit really well, but I think I get where the founders are coming from with this, right? The idea that we're going to teach that there is a future state of rewards and punishments, and we live in a way we should engage our community, our neighbors, whatever, in a way that would strive to be rewarded for behaving well, okay? Now, is this hypocrisy? Is this inconsistency, right? Our founders very clearly said, I want Christianity to be how we function, right? Did the people have the freedom to choose against Christianity? The answer to that is yes, right? Part of this golden triangle of freedom is that relationship between religion and faith and freedom. People were free to make their choices, okay? But they did feel that for the citizenry to thrive, that they were going to go to the best that was available to them to teach, to hold, to embrace, and so forth. And that was found in the Bible, okay? Now, I want to transition to next week a little bit and talk to you about where we're going. Because as you know, we will get off this track a little bit. In America, we have punted the Bible from our schools. When you listen to the public square, you find that people are really, they're edgy about the idea of religious symbolism, about religion even having a required place or even a suggested place in the classroom. In any public sphere, we have traded faith and religion for what I would just call secularism, right? There is very, very little room for it in our country in many places. So if secularism replaces religion, then what's going to happen to our virtue as a country? Do you think that the American morality has declined since we have punted the Bible and our religious convictions from the public square? Do you think morality has gone down? Do you think it has measurably gone down? Absolutely. The question for all of us, this is a foreshadow of week four, is what's going to happen to our freedoms if we know that there's a connection between freedom and virtue? What's going to happen to us as a people and the freedoms that we experience if our morality continues to decline? Okay? We're going to look next week at exactly where we got off track on this and what the consequences have been for us getting off track. Now, I want to read what I believe to be a prophetic speech before we part ways, and I'm happy to open up the floor for questions or for some interaction as well. This next quote, I got shivers the first time I read this, and I think the reason for that is I feel like it speaks very clearly to where we're headed to next week. This final quotation on your handout was written by a 28-year-old young man before he had done anything in life that you would have acknowledged him for. This is a speech by a young Abraham Lincoln before he stepped into public life. Okay, this is him meditating on America. Check this out. He says, we find ourselves in the peaceful possession of the fairest portion of the earth as regards to the extent of our territory, the fertility of our soil, and the salubrity of our climate. I had to look that one up too. Salubrity means promoting health. These old guys had cool vocabularies, huh? So we find ourselves with this incredible piece of land, the extent of our territory, our fertility of our soil, how our climate promotes health, we've got the best. Goes on to say, we find ourselves under the government of a system of political institutions conducing more essentially to the ends of civil and religious liberty than any of which the history of former times tells us. We have got incredible liberties. He says, we find ourselves the legal inheritors of these fundamental blessings. Shall we expect some transatlantic military giant to step the ocean and crush us at a blow? Never. He says, all the armies of Europe, Asia, Africa, combined with all the treasure of the earth except our own in their military chests and with a Bonaparte as a commander, They could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a trek on the Blue Ridge Mountains in the trial of 1,000 years. You take all the armies of the world, of these three continents, blend them, put all the money they have in their military war chest and put Napoleon in charge, and let's have it. And these people will not even take a drink from the Ohio. Interesting. So he says, at what point then is the approach of danger to be expected? I answer, if it ever reach us, it must spring up from among us. It cannot come from abroad. If destruction be our lot, then we must be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. Whoa. Whoa. Isn't that profound? Right? We have got an incredible, incredible country. Lincoln could see all the blessings that we inherited. Right? No one's going to take this from us from the outside. If we're going down, it's going to spring up from among us. I think that's almost prophetic when I read Lincoln's wording on that. Okay? I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer here. I'm not trying to be a heavy in the room. But I look at where Lincoln, at his word choice, I look at what he's saying, and I feel the shift that we're experiencing as a country. And I feel that I resonate with it. I feel there's truth in what he's saying. Okay? I'm going to kick this back to you. We're finished right on time. Is there any questions, any comments? Go ahead, Roger.
Yeah, my grandmother, who went to probably 1900, the Bible was her textbook.
Uh-huh. The Bible was a required textbook in her, yep. And probably not just for your grandmother, probably for your mother as well.
Possibly.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Good. Yeah. Yeah, so if the religion itself isn't free, that also crumbles the triangle. Right? It has to be a free embrace of religion. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Comments, questions?
Is this class recorded?
We're recording this, right? Yeah, I got a thumbs up. Yep. It should be posted on the web. I think we're putting the recording, the PowerPoint on the web. And guys, I'm happy, you've got just a handout of quotes. I'm happy to also make available my teaching notes on this, if you would like that as well. Some of you might want to be doing connections with kids or neighbors. I'm happy to make that available for you guys as well. So, cool. Yeah?
You know, I'm just wondering if it's possible, as Nikita Khrushchev was doing his research before he came here, if he could have seen that quote. I'm just wondering. Because if we all remember what he said, is that they will destroy us from within. Absolutely, if you look what is being followed today, and it is absolutely crushing us from within.
Interesting. Yep. Very good. Yep. I haven't read anything from Khrushchev, so I can't even weigh in on that. But yeah.
Well, just the quote that widely spoken.
For sure. Yep.
I just wonder if he was doing his research, or someone doing it for him.
I wonder. Yep. Anyone else? Final thoughts, final comments, final questions? Good. I want to pray for us, if that's okay. And then we'll part ways and get on to our Sunday. Lord, thanks for a time to gather. Lord, we gather freely. We're able to come to a place and we're able to learn from the book of James and to gather without fear of persecution, without hostility. We're here because we chose to be here. And we have an opportunity to open the book that you've authored, and we get to learn from it. And Lord, we know that there are parts around the world today where just that freedom by itself is not offered. There are churches this morning that are meeting other underground that are trying not to be discovered so that they can gather together to encourage one another and to worship you. Lord, we have been blessed with an incredible piece of land. We've got an incredible civil government. We are fortunate to have been born or to have emigrated to this incredible nation called the United States. Lord, you have blessed this country through the direction that it was pointed in, through the founding fathers, through the way it's operated over 231 years. Lord, thank you for the men that shaped this place. And Lord, we are now the torchbearers. We are the ones that carry forward the vision of the founders. And we might say, well, I'm not a politician, I'm not a civil servant. No, but Lord, we're all Americans. We all contribute to the American experiment. We're all part of this. We're not just consumers of America. We have to also provide America. So, Father, as we go through this four-week time together, would you guide us? Would you convict us to see clearly the ways that you would have us respond? We'd know what our so what is from this time together, that we would not just have more information in our heads, but that we would have practical steps to know how to fight for what America was again. Lord, help us to fall in love again with America, to not just see the warts and the things that are going wrong. Help us to see the shining city on a hill that this place was when it was founded. And help us, Lord, to lead others to that vision. We're grateful, Lord, for this time. And I just pray, Father, you'd bless it. In your name we pray. Amen. Thanks for coming.